Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no, how would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Shawley. A fascinating episode for you today. 55 years ago this week, the former Labour Minister, Labour MP, John Stonehouse, was jailed at the Old Bailey. It was the conclusion of an extraordinary story of how he'd faked his own death in a beach in Miami, turned up in Australia, was eventually brought back to the UK. I've been speaking to his daughter about a new book that she's written, putting her side of the story, what it was like as the child of an MP caught up in all of that, and how she feels about her father today. So that's the big thing coming up on the episode. Before that, it's our columnist panel. It's Thursday, so it must be night at the Marriott, except there is no night. India Knight is off, I don't know, stand-up paddleboarding or whatever it is that she's doing this week. So we have got James Marriott, plus from the New Statesman, Rachel Cunliffe. Now, Rachel, before we get down to business, you're very excited about this, aren't you?
I'm broadcasting with James, which has never happened before.
More than that, you've just tweeted, first time ever broadcasting with James Marriott. I'm ridiculously excited. We've never spoken, but for some reason, I've always imagined we'd be best friends.
I feel really stressed. Yeah, I feel like I threw my best social performance. I don't feel funny enough today.
Channel your columns, James. Channel your columns.
Now, Rachel, is this because you agree with his columns or not?
I think it's because they make me laugh. And I feel like over the last year and a half, humour has been in very, very short supply and everyone's a bit too serious.
Yes, I think you could well be right. There is definitely something in that. We can take the laughter where we can get it. I know that, James, you love awkward social interactions, so I imagine you're really enjoying this.
Yes, well, I kind of seem to be the master of awkward social interactions somehow. I'm not sure I love them, but I seem to end up in them all the time. So,
well, go on then. Let's talk about your column first of all. Culture snobs find new ways to keep us down.
Yes.
Discuss.
Well, the headline is maybe a little bit more combative than the column, but I've just always been really fascinated by snobbery, and especially the kind of disappearance of the old-fashioned kind of snob, the kind of dinner jacket wearing, opera going, posh wine drinking sort of elite metropolitan person who was, you know, such a big deal in, you know, the kind of probably 30s, 40s, 50s for, you know, satirists and stuff. And I read a fascinating academic paper, which has got an incredibly long title. I can't remember, which is called something like Objects and Elite Status or something.
If you've got Genres, Objects and the Contemporary Expression of Higher Status Taste.
Why can't they call my column something that interesting?
You know how to have fun, don't you?
But it's really good because basically the argument of this paper, and it might seem a bit obvious, but it put its finger on something, was that once upon a time, snobbery used to be about particular genres. So the kind of, if you wanted to display your elite cultural tastes, you would listen to classical music or go to the ballet or read sort of difficult poetry. And you'd look down other genres. Now, basically, it's become more complicated, and that the authors say snobbery still kind of exists, but the thing nowadays is to know about a very broad range of genres, but to know within each within each of those genres, which are the kind of socially prestigious things to like. So, you know, they say if you know about hip hop, you like Kendrick Lamar. If you like horror films, you kind of, the culturally prestigious one is like Get Out, Not the Human Centipede. And all these kind of more complicated rules, which they basically say, this is taking too long. they basically say is because, since the Second World War, society has become at least ostensibly more meritocratic, and to prove your social superiority, you don't want to seem like, you know, you have all this inherited privilege. You want to seem like an ordinary man of the people who's just risen to the top. So you have these egalitarian cultural interests within which you demonstrate your superiority by knowing about the particularly prestigious ones, and therefore you seem both a person of distinction but also someone with kind of taste of the common man, which I think is, I just think it's so clever. And I think that's true. I think that's what people are doing. And I think you notice it everywhere now.
Do you notice it everywhere now, Rachel?
Well, I was a bit surprised by that because I'm marrying someone who is a dinner jacket, wine-loving opera fanatic whose favourite contemporary musician or composer is Wagner. So...
Wow.
I think the old snobbishness probably does still exist. Then again, the other night we've got into Love Island for the first time ever. Neither of us have ever watched it before. And we feel okay about liking Love Island because it's all about game theory and psychology. It's not about people in bikinis. It's about watching the prisoner's dilemma playing out on an island in Spain. So maybe we're a bit more guilty of that than we perhaps.
But there were sort of layers of the snobbery, aren't there? Because the snobbery where you could say, well, I'm just not watching Love Island because it's just all about bikinis. You could just say, we are going to watch Love Island because it's all about people in bikinis and their swimming trunks. But you're not. You're sort of trying to you use a sort of different sort of snobbery to justify. So you're still being slightly snobby about it, but your justification is your excuse.
Yeah. Which is something that James actually mentions in the column, the writing about Wonder Woman, the Marvel film, but saying it's all about its feminist themes or has it turned against contemporary feminism? And actually, you can do that with pretty much anything. Again, Marvel films is something that we got into, or that I got into over the winter lockdown when there was literally nothing else to do. And rather than just saying, this is a really cool action film with really high production values, you can say, the psychology is really interesting. Look what it's saying about race. Look what it's saying about contemporary America, when really we're watching for the special effects.
Exactly, because it's nice to switch, like you were saying. You know, you look for the funny in James's columns, or you're switching off for an hour and a half, watching people blowing things up. That's totally fine. There doesn't need to be a message. I've been accused of being a snob this morning, James. Because I tweeted just before the show, as I always do, the question for the text in. Rishi Sunak is following Boris Johnson and taking a staycation. So where would you send politicians on holiday this summer? Lots of people have sent in perfectly fun, you know, jokey responses. Someone called Diana gets in touch. It's not a staycation. Many people don't go abroad each year. They holiday in the UK. It's still a holiday. A staycation is where you stay at home and go for day trips. This whole staycation thing comes across as snobbery from those who can go abroad for holidays each year. No, it isn't. I stayed in the UK to go on holiday this year, but Twitter's particularly bad at this, isn't it?
I can't believe someone on Twitter was being so unreasonable.
Twitter is terrible at this, though, because the controversy yesterday was an editor writing, saying, oh, what are the mistakes, the grammatical errors that you're sick of having to correct, which is something that any editor will have encountered. And the responses to that was, this is snobbish because, you know, some people use different grammar. And you're like, yes, and they are wrong. That's fine.
Somebody, just to be absolutely clear, Colin's been in touch, Rachel, to point out that Wonder Woman is not a Marvel film. So,
is it not?
No, apparently not.
Well, see, that's somebody else's.
It's a DC,
it's
a DC Comics,
there.
Isn't it? It's a different universe. Come on, Collie. Well done for correcting her. But you get the same. It's the sort of Twitter is particularly bad at this, and maybe this seeps into normal life as well, James. But it happened last week with Allegra Stratton's suggestion that some of the small things that people could do to help the environment, one of them was to not rinse your dishes before you put them in the dishwasher. And you've got a whole load of people saying, well, that's not going to work because, you know, that's a tiny thing. You know, China will you know, is building coal-fired power stations. That doesn't make any difference. She's out of touch. Then another load of people say, well, who does that anyway? Then another load of other people can't afford this typical out-of-touch Tory. What about all the people who can't afford a dishwasher? What about all the people who can't afford dishes? What about all the people who, you know, what about people who can't even afford the food to put on the plate, you know? And they're just using, social media is particularly bad at using anything. It's I suppose snobbery and virtual signalling.
Yes, yeah,
is
totally.
Is they're unhappy bedfellows.
I think, yeah, I mean, I think this is all a kind of, it's all just a kind of status game, isn't it? That you can just show off in front of lots of people by having, you know, the cleverest, most morally good take on something. And of course, there's always a more morally good take on anything, and these things tend to become stranger and stranger, and, you know, more and more sort of disconnected from reality. And sometimes things are just a little bit bad and, you know, fine, although a little bit ambiguous, and don't know, we didn't always need...
What's the thing that you're most snobbish about, do you think, James?
Oh, God. Oh, no, do you know what? I probably am a bit snobbish. I don't think I'm snobbish, but I very rarely watch TV. But that's out of this kind of paranoia, I think, that I should always be reading books to get opinion column ideas out of. And if I ever watch TV, I feel a bit twitchy and I'm like, bookshelf. But I don't judge other people for it. I kind of judge myself.
I'm the exact opposite. I'm terrible at reading books because I spend too much time watching telly. What about you, Rachel? Apart from trying to justify your Love Island watching, what's the thing you're most snobbish about?
It's probably grammar, actually, going back to the writing properly. I realise that language is flexible and fluid and it changes over time, but I'm also a classicist and I feel like grammar is important. And if you want to be taken seriously and listened to, it's not unreasonable to try and speak and write according to the rules of the language that you're writing in. That's a very controversial opinion on Twitter.
But it's that whole thing, that some things are facts. You know, that the you can't, well, you know, other people have different views on facts. Well, they aren't. They're not facts then, are they? So if you're, yeah, it just, I'm not sure you're necessarily being snobbish to say that people should use the language properly, but I suspect that others will get in touch and...
I'm going to get comments.
Good old Twitter. Paul in Moscow has been in touch saying, I adore the snobbery of Basil Fawlty in touch of class with Lord Melbury. And that, yeah, that all that of trying to, so people trying to sort of snob up to match the expectations of snobs. Anyway, I probably used the word snob quite enough on.
If we're talking about Love Island, I should just say that various contestants are very good at turning their accents up or down depending on who they're speaking to or what the mood of the villa is. And that's why one of the reasons that I think that Love Island is actually fascinating from an ethnography point of view. And I'm definitely, definitely watching it for that reason.
It's just boys with their tops off. Come on. Let's talk about Boris Johnson and Nicola Sturgeon. Let's move away from... Or maybe there's a bit... This sort of strange game the pair of them play all the time of Boris Johnson goes to Scotland, doesn't want to meet Nicola Sturgeon. Nicola Sturgeon invites him to tea with a tweet, knowing that he won't... Actually, the worst thing that could happen for Nicola Sturgeon is if he took her up on this offer, because then she'd have to meet him. And actually not meeting him is exactly what she wants. And so both of them end up not meeting and everybody's happy. It's a strange world we live in, Rachel.
It is. Actually, as you say, they've both come out of this really well, because what Boris Johnson wants is to be not to be seen to be pandering to Nicola Sturgeon in Scotland. And had he met her, she would have been able to play it as him visiting her country like a foreign dignitary, whereas, of course, he is prime minister of that country, too. So he wanted to avoid meeting her in order to look tough in that way. And she really wanted the chance to say, look, the prime minister has shunned me. And by shunning me, he has shunned and disrespected Scotland, because everyone knows that she is the figurehead for Scotland. And so they both get exactly what they want out of this. And actually, I think that currently the tension between them and the Scotland Westminster tension is playing both of them perfectly towards their bases. Everyone else is kind of fed up and also a little bit worried, if you believe in saving the union, and you'd quite like there to be some move towards compromise and cooperation and working together in the future. But from their individual political perspectives, it plays perfectly for them.
And we're just stuck in this pattern forever, James.
Yeah, it's kind of, see, I always think this about when is there ever going to be a second India referendum? I mean, Michael Gove is kind of hinting what 2024 after the next election, but what will they be saying in 2024? I mean, in a way, as Rachel says, this is kind of kind of quite a beneficial game that both of them are able to kind of play and have on the back burner as a sort of, you know, playing to their particular constituencies. I mean, I suppose the game, you know, if Nicola Sturgeon could win independence for Scotland, that would propel her into a whole kind of new league of political success. But, you know, if she were to lose that referendum, I just think for now, surely it's, you know, that's quite sort of, for both of them to have that issue sort of bubbling away, nicely stoking up their bases, is probably quite a sort of not a bad idea politically.
Yeah, well, we just have to sit and watch, knowing full well what they're both doing, but having to observe it anyway. Have you enjoyed your first interaction with James Marriott, Rachel?
I think it's going okay. How do you think I'm doing? Do you think he likes me?
It's difficult. I mean, he's so snobby about everyone, it's difficult to tell. James, how's your interaction been?
Yeah, well, I thought it was going well, but then when Rachel said it was only okay, I feel a bit, don't know, it's not better than that. I thought I was on sparkling form. Oh, well.
Rachel Cunliffe from the New Statesman there and James Marriott from The Times. And, of course, you can read James' column online right now. Go to thetimes.co.uk where you can get yourself a digital subscription. Right now, you can get your first month for free. Up next is my interview with Julia Stonehouse.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Red Box podcast. Now it's time for this. 55 years ago this week, a Labour MP and former government minister stood in the dock of the Old Bailey and was sentenced to 7 years in prison, condemned by the judge as a persuasive, deceitful and ambitious man. It was the climax of a bizarre story. Sounds like something out of The Rise and Fall of Reginald Perrin. But it was a real-life story of John Stonehouse, a one high-time flyer in the Labour Party. He faked his own death by leaving a pile of clothes on a beach in Miami, stole the identities of two dead constituents, flew around the world before settling in Australia. He only got caught in part because police thought he was Lord Lucan. He was accused in the press of being a fraudster, an adulterer, a thief, even a spy. Now, his daughter, Julia, has sought to tell the story of the man that she still calls a hero. It's called John Stonehouse, My Father, The True Story of the Runaway MP. Her book is out now. I'm delighted that Julia joins me this morning. Good morning, Julia.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us. And I've really enjoyed reading. It was my holiday reading last week, reading your book. Before we get on to this extraordinary story, let's sort of go back to the beginning, if you like. Describe your life in the early 1970s. Your dad's an MP, government minister. He's quite the high flyer, isn't he?
Well, yes. I mean, I spent my teenage years looking at the red box on the, office table, working very hard. Yeah, I mean, I suppose you could call him a high flyer.
And a happy family life? You weren't aware that there was anything wrong before the events of 1974?
Well, I was 23 when he disappeared, and I'd left home at 18. So, I wasn't, if you like, in the thick of it. I was, leading my own life.
So let's focus on those events then. It's November the 20th, 1974, and it's announced by police in Miami that the Labour MP, John Stonehouse, is missing.
We're tracing down every clue, every lead that we can get, and we're encouraging anyone who has any information that might help with the case to get in contact with us. This certainly is a mysterious thing that has happened here.
So let's describe, because this is, I mean, it was an enormous media story then, as it would be if it happened today. Police find his clothes in a neat pile on a beach in Miami. Describe the moment that you were told about this and what you sort of made of it.
Well, I was phoned at work, and my two sisters and I went to my mother's house where we heard about it from a colleague of my father. And our first thought was that he had either had a heart attack or cramp, bad cramp while swimming, because he was a phenomenal swimmer. I mean, he would think nothing of swimming from the shore out, you know, 300 yards or so, floating around a bit and then coming back. Obviously, you know, sharks came into it. You know, we're Florida. Has he been eaten by sharks? Yeah, so that's what we thought. And we thought they were looking in the wrong direction because he swam so far out from shore. We thought that the tides were, you know, they were expecting him to have gone down one end of the coast and not the other end, which he would have gone had he been swimming so far out, which he undoubtedly would have been. So, yeah.
So you spent quite a lot of time in the dark. Let's take a listen. It was your mother speaking at the time.
I've heard some extraordinary rumours, and they're all so much out of character with my husband's personality that, you know, I mean, they're just not worth answering or worth thinking about. I'm convinced in my mind that it was a drowning accident.
So that was, as you were saying at the time, you were convinced that he had drowned, you were, while he was, and we'll discuss in a moment what he was getting up to, and then the 5 weeks before he turned up, the media scrum that you and your family found yourself in was extraordinary, wasn't it? And you recount it in the book in some detail, but you know, having to run across fields to try and get in and out of a cottage that you were staying in, and the media assuming that he was dead, as everyone was, essentially feeling like it was a free for all. They could write and say what they liked about him.
Well, you can't sue somebody if they're, you know, for libel and whatnot if they say something about you when you're dead. So yes, I'm afraid it was rather a scrum. It was actually horrific. Every day there was something. Every single day. I mean, just every permutation you can think of, a concrete coffin with, you know, hair samples required, a Nigerian found floating in the Thames, the mafia, insurance fraud, I mean, all sorts of things. And so much of it, we just literally couldn't understand. I mean, you know, the insurance policies were 5 years, 5 years, 5 years, 7 years. They could never be claimed without a body. And then there was one for 10 years, which he took out, you know, my mother, in fact, took out shortly after his car was blown to smithereens by an IRA bomb at Heathrow Airport. So that seemed to us entirely sensible to take out life insurance, you know, but he got 30 years for life insurance.
And the let's touch on the allegations of him being a Czech spy. It reached such a sort of fever, if you like, that even the Prime Minister Harold Wilson had to make a statement about it in the House of Commons.
Yeah. I mean, the first of all, the defector who said this, he'd never seen the file, never given him any money, never, you know, even met the man. But there was a file, a Czech file in the embassy. But anybody who'd gone over to Eastern Europe would acquire a file. And he had gone there with the Cooperative Society, and he had arranged the twinning of his constituency of Wednesbury with the town of Kladno. And there is, in fact, still, if you go there today, Kladno, you'll see there's a street called Wednesbury. So that's kind of how meetings started. And he did have meetings. He also had meetings about trying to sell them the VC-10 commercial aircraft to the Czech and national airlines. And it wasn't just them. He sold them to Middle East Airlines, Ghana Airways, you know, all kinds of people. In fact, that's why he was made a privy councillor, because he sold more exports than anybody else. So, yes, he did have meetings with them. But my contention is that, first of all, there are no secrets in the file. I mean, everybody says that. Nobody can find a single secret in there. What we're talking about is what they call low-level information. Some say it's not even stuff from the Times newspaper or Hansard or, you know, the Westminster Reference Library collection of periodicals. It's more like gossip. So we can immediately go from spy to gossip. OK, let's say an agent. But my contention with that is that nobody has ever phoned us and said, well, look, they've got an address in this file, which is 22 Aldwyn Road. Did you ever live there? And the answer to that is no. So they have this system of calling him to meetings, which involved cutting a piece out of the Times with a date showing and then sending it to him. And that would be calling him to a meeting a week hence. It was always lunchtime. By default, it was Beale's Restaurant in Holloway Road. And if they put a Roman numeral 2 next to the date, that indicated the meeting was to be held at the Black Horse pub in Catford. The problem is, you know, we never lived at this address they had for us. And yet in the file, they have 27 reports being sent back to Prague talking about this Times method of calling him to meetings. Well, we never lived there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you go into that in some detail in the book too. So all this is swirling around. He's assumed to be dead. Allegations, rumours, gossip swirling in the papers. And then it's Christmas Eve 1974, so 5 weeks after he went missing. The family's up late wrapping Christmas presents, reminiscing about your father as anyone would do at Christmas. It's late at night. The phone rings.
Yeah, it was 1 o'clock and a journalist phoned and said there's been a report that your father's turned up in Australia. That there would be a press conference in Melbourne at 4 o'clock our time, 4 a.m. So we put the phone down and then the phone just never stopped ringing. So we decided to take the phone off the hook and wait until 4 a.m. until we got, the press conference news. First of all, we thought it might be his brother because he had lived in Australia. He was a pilot for BOAC and, we thought they'd got things mixed up. So we were kind of elated. Then we would have thought, no, it's a mistake. And we didn't know what to think. And then at 4 o'clock, we got the news and it was my father on the phone saying to my mother, yes, please come to Australia and bring Sheila with you.
Yes. So let's explain right. In this already quite complicated story. Let's explain who Sheila Buckley is.
OK, so Sheila Buckley was my father's mistress and secretary. She's so maligned, really, Sheila. She's had a really rough deal. She should never have been convicted of 2 years, which she got a 2-year conditional charge. Everybody thinks she was, quote, in it from the beginning. But basically, Sheila, what happened was he called her after he, in the period when he was missing, he called her from Hawaii a couple of times. He met her in Copenhagen for a day and a half. And he said, would she write to him? And she subsequently wrote him 4 letters. But all of that was after he disappeared. What really threw things for Sheila was that there was a newspaper article in February 1975 that said, my father had arranged for her clothes to be sent out in a trunk. It's actually quite a complicated story involving a red Samsonite suitcase and one thing and another. But anyway, this was in the newspapers. It was picked up by the other newspapers. When we went to committal in October 75, back in the UK, it was repeated by the newspapers and we went to trial and so on. But anyway, the point is that the customs officer who opened that trunk, a man called Robert Hill, when he opened it, there were no women's clothes in that trunk. So it was a completely kind of made up story.
But the thing that really strikes me is that she did, although you'd say that she didn't know about it before he disappeared, she had known for some time that he was in Australia, was writing letters to him. She'd known about, certainly, you know, you thought your father was dead and she had known about it.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, credit where it's due. She obviously it's annoying when somebody knows your father's dead and you think he's been eaten by sharks, you know, but she was worried about his mental health and thought he might commit suicide. And she was just protecting him. And when we realized that he had, in fact, had this terrible breakdown, which my mother realized as soon as she arrived in Australia, which she flew to Christmas Day, basically. His voice was really high. It was high pitched. He lost weight. He was just completely not himself. He was he had a breakdown, no doubt about it. And probably I say probably very much so, exacerbated by overdosing on Mandrax.
That's the drug that I know he was later back. Let's explain what was going on in Australia. Each morning he gets up in Australia and he goes and buys a copy of the Times, as everyone should do, to find out what's going on back home. But he'd, as I explained in the introduction, he'd taken the identities of two constituents, Joe Markham and Clive Mildoon. I mean, that in itself is a, I think we'll agree, a pretty appalling thing to have done. Set about opening up this sort of incredibly complicated network of bank accounts in the two names. So complicated, in fact, that it seems as if even he struggled to keep across what he was doing?
Definitely. I mean, he booked into one hotel using the name Markham and Muldoon. I mean, the guy on reception was completely confused. He didn't know who he was because he used two names. And then he got a little apartment on Flinders Street. He told Mr. Wilcox that his name was Markham, and he told Mrs. Wilcox his name was Muldoon, or vice versa. And they were confused. I mean, he was confused. He didn't know who he was. He was going into banks. He was caught. He was spotted literally a day and a half after arriving in Melbourne because of his own ridiculous behaviour. He was taking large money out of one bank and in one name and putting it in another bank in another name. And there was a guy called Mr. King who worked at the second bank, and his regular lunchtime routine was to have his sandwiches in his staff room and then go for a walk along Collins Street where all the banks are. And he saw the man he knew as Muldoon coming out of another bank where the teller there told him his name was Markham. And the two of them put their heads together. I mean, he'd been in Melbourne a day and a half, and they'd already called the police. They thought fraud was going on.
And they thought there's a well-dressed, posh Englishman behaving peculiarly, opening up bank accounts in strange names. And they think maybe it's Lord Lucan, who's also gone missing around the same time. Explain how they established that it wasn't Lord Lucan.
They never thought it was Lucan. I'm afraid that's one of the myths. Lucan only kind of came into the subject when one of Sheila's letters were opened. And because of the insurance issue, and of course, my mother would have been a beneficiary had she ever claimed, which of course she never did. The issue then would have been, did she murder him? That was another news story at the time. Did my mother murder my father for the insurance money? And so the word murder was in that letter. And that was the first time that the police thought, oh, murder, what's this? Because it was all coded, the letter. Nobody could understand it. I mean, if you read the letters, they're completely incomprehensible, especially to my father and certainly to the police. So that was kind of what kind of alerted them to the whole Markham issue.
Yeah, and then he was arrested and ultimately did come back to the UK. So he's in Australia. He asked your mother to go out to Australia to meet him. He also asks her to bring his mistress with her to Australia, he treated your mother particularly badly, didn't he? Including, as you recount in your book, I mean, he physically assaulted her on one occasion, grabbing her hair, banging her head up and down, beating her with a telephone handset until it shattered. He behaved appallingly to your mother.
He did, but you've got to bear in mind, Matt, all of this is completely out of character. My father was never, ever violent. This was all completely, new to us. And you've got to remember, too, that he was withdrawing from Mandrax and Mogadon, which he'd been, taking too much of, basically, for 2 years. A drug, it started as methaqualone, and he took that from 1966 when he was... Undersecretary of State at the colonies. He was flying all over the world, and he put a little label, attach it to his shirt, saying, please don't wake me. I don't need water or drink. Because when he got off the plane, he would, go straight into meetings. And of course, 66, we're talking about a lot of countries becoming independent or planning to, and a lot of work going on, a lot of flying around. And he would take the methaqualone to sleep on the plane. So he'd been taking it for a long time, but when he got to 72 and a lot of particular stress came along, he started taking too many of them, and in a cocktail with Mogadon, and he was withdrawing.
Julie, I'll tell you what, the thing that really struck me reading the book is how and maybe this is just a relationship of father daughter, how amazingly forgiving you are of him. Given that he was happy for you to think that he was dead, he was going to turn up in, it had all gone according to plan, he would have never seen you again. You'd assumed he was dead, and he would have started this new life in Australia. And then, the way he treated your mother and, his business interests, his political interests, you're amazingly forgiving of it, where lots of people would have thought, I could never have forgiven my father for behaving in the way that he did.
It's not just me, Matt. It's my whole family. You know, my mother, you know, siblings, you know, everybody in our immediate family, because we completely understand that he had a serious mental breakdown. And he was getting drugs, Mandrax, Mandy's, Quaaludes, whatever you want to call them, from a variety of doctors. He'd walk down the corridors of the House of Commons and he'd see a doctor. And he would get a prescription from him, and then he'd see another one and get one from him and his own doctor and the House of Commons doctor. And, you know, I opened up his when my mother went to Australia at Christmas after he reappeared, I went to stay in their house in Kennington. And my parents had separate bathrooms. I don't think my mother was aware of how many drugs he had, but I was in the guest bedroom, so now I'm using the same bathroom he had. And I opened up the cabinet one day, and there were three rows, you know, those little cabinets with kind of, you know, little shelves, three rows of bottles of Mandrax and Mogadon. I mean, it's completely ridiculous. He was just knocking them back because he'd been taking them on a regular basis, ad hoc basis, since 1966. He thought he was safe with them, but of course, the more you take, the more you need, and so on and so forth. And I wouldn't say overdosing. I mean, he didn't, you know, die of them, but at the same time, he was knocking them back, something ridiculous. And Mandrax can drive you crazy, drive you to suicide. I mean, that's why it's been banned since 1984, 10 years too late for my father.
So there he is. He's in Australia, initially refusing to even to give up his seat in the House of Commons. So he wants to stay in Australia because he wants to face justice there instead. Eventually does come home to face the music, to face the charges that we were discussing a few moments ago. And he spoke to the BBC when he was back in Britain.
I have been sick. My psychiatrist confirms that. And I think a Member of Parliament, like anybody else in any other job, is entitled to some consideration during a period when he has some sort of illness. Of course I regret it, and I'm sorry for all the anguish that's been created, deeply sorry. But in my confused state, I thought, frankly, that the old John Stonehouse was better dead than alive.
It's an extraordinary thing, and there he is reflecting on the describing his own illness, as you describe it as well, Julia. Later, like I said, he was jailed. He was later released early from prison on health grounds. He then divorced your mother, married his mistress and former secretary, Sheila Buckley, and had a child with her too. And then your father sadly died in 1988 from a heart attack. How do you reflect on him now? Reading your book, where you describe how you say that for most people, John Stonehouse will forever remain the infamous runaway MP. But to me, my wonderful father was a hero. And I confess, I really struggled with that sentiment, reading your... I mean, it's a lovely book, but I really struggled with that sentiment, given the extraordinary story, the extraordinary, even as he described there, the anguish that he put you and your family through.
Well, you know, 18 people will commit suicide today, most of them men. And, you know, mental health is an issue that, you know, you don't go blaming people for committing suicide. You don't blame them for having a nervous breakdown. That would be completely, you know, out of order. And look at the work he did. Nobody ever talks about the work he did. I mean, he was such a fierce anti-colonial fighter. I mean, he paid the price for that, because behind this whole story, I mean, we're talking about, if you like, the drama of it. But behind all this, there's politics. You know, there's the forces that worked against anti-colonialism. We had all kinds of, I mean, we had bomb threats, the kidnapping threats, you know, Blacks Go Home painted on the front steps. I mean, you know, on the pavement outside. I came out the house and stood in a great puddle of industrial super glue, couldn't move. You know, I mean, we paid a price in as a family, you know, for that. If you fight that battle, you're up against a lot of forces, and the what was going on behind is actually a very interesting side of this story, which nobody ever talks about, except of course I do. And I consider him a hero because of the work he did politically.
And you do, you tell that story well in your book as well. Julia, it's been lovely to speak to you. Julia Stonehouse. That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. We bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from?
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.